Nothing can be done about that. They've been filed, intentionally. Whoever did that to her needs to be arrested, Casey. It's assault at the very least.
I did it to myself, Marianne says, her voice very quiet.
April frowns. For what purpose?
April, I say. No, it's all right, Marianne says. I know you need to hear my story, Casey. Whether it's to help this baby or the poor dead woman or the hostels in general, you need it. I'm just not sure it will make much sense. It's like a fever dream. I'd never done drugs. Well, nothing stronger than marijuana, but we didn't consider that any more a drug than alcohol. I certainly never experienced hallucinations with it.
You wouldn't, April says. Marijuana is not a hallucinogenic drug. Marianne meets my gaze and the corners of her lips quirk, as if she's figuring out my sister. She just says, calmly,
No, I suppose it isn't. But I had friends who experimented with hallucinogens. Sometimes what they experienced wasn't so much a hallucination as a waking dream. It was real. Very real. Yeah, that's what it was like for me. It was real, and I had no sense that it wasn't normal, that this wasn't who I was.
She stops, squeezes her eyes shut, and shakes her head.
No, that's not quite right. In the beginning,
she looks at April.
I'm sorry, doctor, you were conducting an examination. I'll wait for this.
April looks at me. I'd like Marianne to continue. I'm afraid if she stops, she won't ever restart. I'm still hesitating when Jen opens the door, baby in one arm, dinner in a bag over her shoulder. I tell April to continue her examination, and I take the baby, who is indeed fussing, sucking on her lower lip as if she's a few seconds from crying.
Is this the baby?
Marianne says, rising. A smile spreads. A real one, her entire face lighting up as she forgets to cover her teeth.
The one who was with a former hostel?
I nod. The woman wasn't her mother, though.
No, she wouldn't be.
She swallows.
There are no babies. They do not.
She rubs her hands over her face, the move agitated as if she's trying to scrub a memory from her mind. She stops, forcing her hands down. When she speaks, her voice is lecture impassive.
If we become pregnant, they make sure we do not stay that way.
She catches our expressions and shakes her head.
No, not me. I had a hysterectomy a few years before I came to Rockton. I was spared that.
April and I exchange a glance. Then April says, I would like to conduct a full physical examination. Given the circumstances you were living under, there could be damage that your hysterectomy would not have prevented. Marianne looks at her a moment before realizing what she means. She gives a short laugh.
No, oddly, that is another thing I was spared. Children are forbidden, but so is rape. Sex must be consensual.
She pauses.
Or as consensual as it can be. Under the circumstances.
Another pause, and a wan quarter smile.
From an academic perspective, let's just say it was as consensual as it has historically been for women. We knew the advantage of taking a mate, and we did so. And while I did not meet the love of my life, my relationships were, in some ways, healthier than the one I came here to escape. You may certainly conduct a full exam, doctor, but rape trauma is the one thing I don't suffer from.
The baby sleeps, and Marianne relaxes into the examination. I know from experience that bouncing back from the physical ailments is usually the easy part. The human body is a marvel of resiliency. The mind is an entirely different matter. On the surface, it has that same resiliency. Yet even after we seem to be back on our mental feet, functioning and happy, the damage lingers, tucked down in the creases,
impossible to scour clean. The body repairs itself, leaving only scars where the skin can't quite smooth away the damage. The mind does the same. It reforms, it adapts, it builds bridges over the damaged parts. I can hide my physical scars with long sleeves and jeans, but I don't. They're part of who I am, part of my history, and no cause for shame. I wish I could be as open with the mental scars. I probably never will be. The physical damages make me look like a survivor. The psychological damage makes me feel like a victim. I know that's wrong. I just can't seem to get past the divide. Marianne's scars will not be badges of honor. They do show that she survived trauma that would kill most people. Yet she won't ever feel that way. When she's ready to return to civilization, be that Rockton or Halifax, she'll want help covering those signs. In her examination, April suggests ways to conceal the rest of the physical damage. It's reassuring for Marianne, hearing her trauma discussed in the same way a cosmetic surgeon might suggest fixing a crooked nose. April doesn't mean it to be soothing. She's ticking off the boxes that will return her patient to optimal health. Yet Marianne is soothed. And that's what counts. Caps will cover her filed teeth. Plastic surgery will remove blackened tissue and make the frostbite damage less obvious. Marianne eats after her physical. As she does, while April makes notes, I say, "May I ask you questions?" She smiles. "May I hold the baby afterward?" "Certainly." I have 1,000 questions, as you might imagine, but I want to begin with ones that April may be able to help me with. My sister looks up. She says nothing, though. Just resumes her note-making. "You say that your party was attacked in the night," I begin. "The party who left Rockton with you." "Yes." "Were they the same people who took you away? Held you captive?" She nods. "Yes." "Is there any chance they weren't? I know you said it was chaotic. Is it possible you were attacked by one group and then given to another?" I get identical looks of confusion from Marianne and April. Marianne says slowly, "I'm not sure I understand. Is there any chance that the people who attacked your camp were not the group you later joined? Or if there were any members you never saw again?" "It really was a blur of faces, both at the attack and later." She pauses. "It may be if I had a better idea what you were looking for." I hesitate. As a cop, I would never share a theory with a witness, not unless I'm trying to lead them into confessing themselves. Otherwise, it really is leading, tainting their testimony. So I have to stop here and analyze. What are the chances that if I give Marianne a theory, she'll intentionally or subconsciously shape her testimony to support or refute it, depending on her gut reaction? She is a scientist. Whatever damage she suffered, she's made incredible strides toward recovery. Her intelligence and self-awareness have fully returned, and I think I need to trust that. "I'm not a psychiatrist," I say, "or a psychologist, or an anthropologist, or anyone else who might know more about human evolution and behavioral changes. But I struggle with the idea that people who leave Rockton, modern humans, can revert to something that primitive in a few years." I adjust the baby to my other arm. "The theory in Rockton has always been, simply, that these people left, and because they left, they reverted to a more primitive form. That they were inherently more violent than the settlers, and they embraced that part of themselves when they left. I don't think that's how it works with people. I think there must be some outside influence that at least escalates the process."
"You're completely right," Marianne says. "What happens out there isn't a natural process of devolution. It's the T."
Chapter 18. The tea? That's all I can manage. And when April asks, "Who provides the tea?" I am grateful.
Then I'm immediately shamed by that gratitude because I'm only glad that I'm not the one asking what might be a stupid question.
No one, right? I say to Marianne. They make it themselves.
She nods.
From a root and plants. I don't know the exact ingredients. The shaman is the only one who can make them.
Shaman?
That's what I'd call her now. They don't have a name for any roles. The shaman conducts rituals and makes the teas.
Teas, April says. More than one? Marianne hesitates.
Maybe. I always thought of it as the same tea, but in two concentrations. One is for everyday drinking, and the other is for rituals.
They both, Marianne rubs her face again, this time paired with a convulsive shiver. When she speaks, her voice is lower, professorial detachment evaporating.
They make everything okay.
Neither of us speaks. After a moment, Marianne says,
May I go back?
When I tense, she manages a wan smile.
I don't mean go back into the forest. I mean, may I go back to my story? That will make this easier and possibly more comprehensible if such a thing is possible.
Of course, I say. Whatever works for you. I glance at my sister. You don't need to be here for this. She starts as if from sleep, blinks, pauses, then straightens, saying, If we are discussing the effects of a potential drug, then I do believe I need to stay. She doesn't actually need to stay, and I realize I have inadvertently achieved exactly the thing I tried to so many years ago. I have brought April something that catches her interest. Still, I have to ask Marianne if she's okay with April staying. She is. Marianne continues.
I told Casey that the hostiles attacked at night. They killed the men and took the women. Two of us. We were initially separated. A classic technique. Separate. Isolate. Disorientate. I woke in a cavern, too small to sit up in. I had a guard. He wouldn't speak to me. Wouldn't even look at me. They'd only bring water. I was in that cave for days, maybe a week. By the time they hauled me out, I was starving and feverish and half mad with fear and confusion. They gave me food and the tea. As soon as I drank the tea, I knew it was drugged. Everything became unreal. She shifts her position. That's the best way to describe it. It took away the fear and the dread. When they put me back into the cave, I slept soundly. The next day, they brought me out and offered me food and more tea. I only wanted the food. That wasn't an option. Both or nothing. I refused the tea for 3 days until I realized my choices were that or starvation. I drank. And they let me stay outside the cave with the group. It felt like I was in a trance. Doing as I was told earned me food and sleeping blankets and a spot by the fire. The chores were like being at camp. Gather wood, cook, clean, sew. A few of the men paid me extra attention, but they didn't bother me. They were trying to get my attention. As a potential mate, yes. During my more lucid periods, I'd remember to be afraid, to want to escape. The best plan, however, seemed to be to do exactly what they wanted. Just keep drinking the tea and being a good girl, and I'd get my chance. Then they brought Laura.
The other woman who'd been taken with you. She nods.
Laura wouldn't drink the tea. They brought her to show her how well I was doing, how much better shape I was in. I tried to persuade her to drink and bide her time, but to her, I was weak, surrendering when I should be fighting. She was a 25-year-old wilderness guide, tough as nails. I was a middle-aged academic. We'd never really gotten along. She fought them every waking second, and eventually, they fought back. They beat her. They gave her only enough water to survive. Then they took away her clothing. After a week, she escaped. I raise my brows, and Marianne nods. Yes, they let her escape. I realize that later. One of the men tracked her. A week later, she swallows and rubs her face. They took me to see her, to see what was left. I tell her she doesn't need to continue, but she says, no, this is part of the story. Another few minutes of silence before she says, she'd collapsed. Exhaustion, hypothermia, starvation. She couldn't go on. The tracker had tied her to a tree. Then he put tea beside her. Drink the tea and he'd give her food and clothing. She didn't. And so he left her there. And I, Marianne swallows. I hope she just fell asleep. Died quietly. If not, another swallow, harder. Something got her. An animal. Either it scavenged her dead body or it killed her. That's what they brought me to see, and that was a message. Drink your tea and behave, and do not even think of running, or this will happen to you.
So you stayed.
I still plan to escape. I'd give it a month, even two, until they trusted me. I'd be fed and strong, and I'd have clothing and weapons, and I wouldn't end up like Laura when I ran. Then they gave me the other tea. There was no peaceful trance with that.
She looks at me.
I've never been an angry person. No matter what my husband did, I stayed calm and looked for solutions. I had anger, though, and that tea brought it out. It induced hallucinations and violent frenzies, and her face reddens. It induced all the impulses. It unleashed the id. And it was addictive. Not so much the drug itself, as the experience. Cathartic. In my already confused state, it felt as if I'd discovered something I'd been looking for all my life. Like our family friends, dreaming of walking into the wilderness and reuniting with Mother Nature. I embraced it. And I'm ashamed of that now. But when it happened, she looks at me. Most of the time, we drank the first tea, the same as you'd have your morning Earl Grey. Then there were the rituals with the other one, so you went from a sense of tranquil unreality to those wild primal frenzies. There wasn't anything else. After a while, it became harder to focus, harder to think straight. All that mattered was surviving, hunting, finding shelter, protecting territory, satisfying needs and urges.
She shifts her position again.
When I met you and Eric in the forest that first time, I was in what you might call a down phase. We all were. In a frenzy, we'd have attacked and taken what we wanted. But in the down phase, they could think it through enough only to threaten you.
They'd still have killed us, though, I say. That's why they asked Eric to remove his clothing, so they wouldn't ruin it when they killed him. She nods.
Yes. They'd have killed him and any other men in your party. They'd have taken you. Young, strong men seem like an asset, but they're also competition for goods and women. A young, strong woman is the truly valuable asset.
She inhales.
I didn't recognize Eric. That's no excuse. I was still watching them do exactly what they'd done to my own party from Rockton, and I wasn't lifting a finger to stop it.
You couldn't.
Yes, but I wouldn't have either. In that phase, I would regret what happened, but it would never occur to me to stop it. When I did recognize Eric, though, it was like a light in the darkness. That one tiny pinprick that cut through the fog. Once I started remembering, I couldn't stop. It helped that I didn't go back to the tribe. That wasn't really a choice.
Our entire hunting party had been wiped out, including our leader. I'd lost my mate a few months before, and that left me vulnerable. I had enemies, including the shaman, who was the dead leader's mate. Not returning turned out to be my salvation. My mind didn't clear overnight. Even now, sometimes I wake up and I can't remember how I got where I am. I'm alive, though, so I'm clearly not wandering around in a daze. I think it's more like blackouts, lost memory.
Effects of long-term drug use, April says. My doctoral advisor had a subspecialty in hallucinogens. What you are likely looking at is something that produces effects similar to PCP. Long-term use leads to long-term effects, as with most drugs. Blackouts or loss of memory would be one of them.
Will that stop? Marianne asks.
While I believe that long-term implies it isn't permanent, I can't say that without further research.
Which we will do, I add quickly. If it isn't likely to clear up on its own, there must be treatments.
April gives me a look. Brain damage isn't something that heals like torn tissue, and she doesn't want me sounding so certain. But thankfully, she doesn't say anything. Marianne isn't a child needing sunshine and roses, but she is fragile. And if I lean one way, it'll be toward convincing her that a normal life is possible. It helps that I believe it. I've seen people come back from situations that I'm not sure I could have psychologically survived. Determination and optimism might not solve every issue, but it gets you a good chunk of the way there. For all my sister's challenges, she understands this. She would never tell Kenny that he won't walk again, and nor will she tell Marianne her mind might never fully heal. Her glare just warns me to watch my step. Because I'm such a sunshine and roses person myself that I might blithely lead poor Marianne down the happy path of delusive hope. Yeah. My sister really needs to get to know me better. With that, we reach the end of what Marianne can tell me for now. I have more questions, so many more, but she's tiring, and that trip down memory lane wasn't a joyful one. As eager as I am to take her to try identifying the dead woman, she needs a rest first, and again, I'm otherwise stalled until Dalton returns, hopefully with information on where to find the baby's parents.
Chapter 19. As Marianne naps, so does the baby, while I make notes on Marianne's story. As I watch the baby soundly sleeping, I marvel at my maternal skill. All those stories about babies crying constantly and moms never getting a moment to themselves, and here I am, with time to write down all my notes and then make coffee and even leaf through a novel I'd accidentally left under my old sofa. Clearly, Edwin is right, and I'm a natural mother. Yeah, I'm not that delusional. The baby deserves all the credit for this. I'm guessing that at this age, they sleep a lot of the time, like Storm and Raoul did as puppies. Also, having lived in the wilderness, born in winter, the baby wouldn't be accustomed to a cushy life where mom and dad can jump to fulfill her every need. She's curled up with Marianne on the sofa, snuggled deep into a soft source of body heat, and she's happy. The baby does eventually fuss, and I take her from Marianne, who is so deeply asleep that if the house caught fire, I'd need to haul her out. Alone in the wilderness, she's probably done little more than nap for months now, staying just warm enough to doze without drifting into the endless slumber of hypothermia. When Marianne does wake, I summon Jen to take the baby while I finally escort Marianne to the clinic, where I hope she can identify the dead woman. We're at the clinic, having come in the back way. April has made sure it's empty, and I ask her to stay in the front room in case anyone arrives. Marianne and I walk in to find the dead woman on the examining table. Marianne takes one look and stops mid-step. I resist the urge to jump in with questions. I can see mental wheels turning, and I don't want to do anything to put on the brakes. Marianne walks to the table. She looks down and whispers,
"I'm Ellen."
She looks over at me.
"That's what she said. I'm Ellen.
I met her." Marianne looks around and I push over a chair. She eyes it, this simple object that would once have been so familiar, Then she gingerly lowers herself onto it. I pull another chair from the next room and sit in front of her.
"Met isn't quite the right word," Marianne says.
"I encountered her. It was," she shakes her head.
"Oh, time is difficult to judge. I remember it was warm that day. It might have been last summer. It could even have been the one before."
"Oh, I'm sorry, I can't be more specific."
"That's fine.
We were gathering berries.
If you need the exact time of year, that could help. They were crowberries. I was with the shaman and the two other women from our group.
She," Marianne gestures toward the dead woman, "came out of the woods.
Carefully. I remember that.
She made enough noise so we'd hear her, and she had her hands raised so we could see she wasn't armed.
She did everything right."
"And?"
"The shaman tried to kill her. It was like the men with Eric. He'd be an asset as a worker, as a fighter, but all they see is competition. Our power, as with most patriarchal tribes, came from our mates. Fewer women means more opportunity to snag a powerful man.
Yes, and I would strongly suspect that freeing Laura was the shaman's idea. Laura was young and strong and pretty. If she'd survived, she could have taken the best mate, become the most powerful woman, possibly even become shaman.
This woman," she nods at the body, "wasn't young, but she'd still be competition. The shaman ran her off and tried to get us to hunt and kill her as a supposed threat to the group. We were in a down phase, though, so myself and the other women pretended to give chase, but didn't put much effort into it. She got away easily."
"Do you know what she wanted?"
"That's what I'm struggling to remember. She spoke to us, but while I would have understood her at the time, the memory faded quickly. What I remember isn't the conversation, but the gist of it. She wanted to help us. I was confused at first because she said something about help, and I thought she needed help, but that wasn't it. She wanted to help us.
But before that, you didn't know her. She wasn't from your tribe."
Marianne shakes her head. "She was a settler, not a hostile."
"Could you take a look at this?"
I rise and fold back the sheet to show the woman's, Ellen's, upper chest scarring. Before I can say anything, Marianne sucks in breath.
"Oh," she says, "that's, yes, that's the other group."
She looks at me.
"There are two tribes in this area. I don't know if there are more farther afield, but we only had contact with this other one and as little of that as possible. It was like two wolf packs, equally matched in size, with enough territory that they didn't need to cross paths. My feeling is that the two groups had been linked at some point.
One initial group that split," I say, "like Rockton and the settlements."
"Yes, but that's just my presumption. It wasn't as if we sat around talking about tribal history. I don't know if it was the drugs themselves or the result of living that way, but everything was very focused on the now. Any discussions we had were the simple exchange of information needed in the moment. The fire is too small. We need more kindling. Hey, that's my meat." Even things like hunts or gathering expeditions were very in the moment. "We're running low on meat, so we need to hunt. It's blueberry season, so we should pick blueberries. When someone died, we buried him and divided up his things and rarely referred to him again."
She takes a deep breath.
"And that's the very long way of saying that there were two tribes, but we didn't interact. And if there was any connection between the two, no one ever mentioned it to me."
Marianne runs her fingertips over the woman's raised scars.
"This is definitely their work. When I met her, though, I had no sense she was a hostile. If anyone had suspected she came from the other tribe, that would have been far more worrisome, being so deep into our territory. My guess is that she'd been a hostile and left them. She has facial markings, too, which she covered with dirt. The chest ones seem unfinished, but they aren't fresh. Left her tribe to become a settler. That would also explain why she'd reached out to us as a party of women. Like an ex-cult member trying to help those still drinking the Kool-Aid. A wry twist of a smile. Or, in our case, the tea. She steps back for a broader view of the woman. If she did leave her tribe and stumbled onto them again, that might have explained how she died. They would have killed her. I see you've shaved part of her head. I'm guessing that was what did it. A blow to the skull. Is that a common attack method for hostiles? A humorless chuckle. Their murder modus operandi is whatever gets the job done. They have knives, but they'd grab a rock if that was closest at hand. She did suffer blunt force trauma, I say. But cause of death was a shotgun pellet. Well, then that's not the hostiles. Some use bow and arrows, but no one would ever get access to a gun, much less ammunition. So I have a name for the woman. The fact that she tried to help Marianne and the others gave me some small insight into her. While she could have stolen this baby for herself, I'm leaning harder now toward other possibilities. If the baby's mother belonged to the trading family that Edwin dislikes, then perhaps Ellen thought she was saving the child. With Marianne and the others, rescue would have been warranted. With the child, though? We were back to the problem Dalton and I discussed yesterday. At what point do you declare parents unfit? The baby is healthy, showing absolutely no signs of neglect or abuse. Yet, according to Edwin, the family prostitutes its daughters. If he's right about that, then looking after a baby girl is little different than treating your sled dogs well. What if that is the sort of situation we find? A child who will grow up to that sort of life? For now, I need to focus on finding the baby's parents. I hope Cypher can shed more light on that. Chapter 20. I talked to Phil about Marianne. I'm trying to play fair with all parties, especially in light of the, whoops, guess the council isn't responsible for hostiles, revelation. I'm feeling sheepish about that, and in response, I decide to be above board regarding Marianne's presence. I explain to Phil. He responds with a shake of his head and zero questions, as if he's beyond surprise when it comes to Rockton. He'll tell the council Marianne is here and sees no issue with that. It's a humanitarian gesture. At one time, I'd have thought Phil incapable of understanding that concept. While he doesn't exactly trip over himself to offer her hospitality, he doesn't question giving her a house for the night, food, fresh clothing, and supplies come morning. I've brought the baby back from Jen's, and Marianne is resting, so I've requisitioned a men's parka from the supply shop, put the baby into the front sling we fashioned yesterday, and tucked her under the jacket. We're both restless, and walking with her seemed like a fine solution, though it might suggest that I have far more experience with puppies than babies. She doesn't sleep, but she settles in with only the occasional grunt to let me know she's there. Walking through town means more stopping and greeting than actual movement, especially when I have a baby strapped to my chest. It's like walking storm. Even after a year, people still stop me to give her a pat. The baby doesn't want to be patted. She conveys that with a yowl the first time a resident's icy fingers touch her cheek. So I take her out of town. There's a path that runs just beyond the forest edge, one that residents are allowed to use if they really feel the need to commune with nature. I can go farther, of course, perks of being law enforcement, but with the baby, I'll stick close. It's also dark. Not night yet, not even dinner time, but dark nonetheless. I see the glow of Dalton's flashlight first, bobbing along like fairy fire. Then Storm gives a happy bark and thunders down the path. I drop to one knee before she bowls me over. While I pet her, she dances and whines as if we've been separated for months. Then she sticks her big nose into my parka and licks the baby. The baby's head rolls back as if trying to see. Storm snuffles the black-fuzzed head, and the baby only grunts in surprise. Dalton approaches with a guy half a head taller than him, a burly bulk of a man with a snow-crusted beard halfway down his chest. As I stand, Cipher says,
"Either that's a baby under your coat, kitten, or you've taken up serious snacking."
"My snacking habits are none of your concern," I say. "But yes, it is a baby." Cipher gives me a one-armed hug, which I return. Then he peers down at the baby, who whimpers in alarm.
"Still scaring dogs and small children," Dalton says. "You might want to trim that beard."
He pauses.
"No, I guess at her age, she can't see more than shapes. It must be the smell."
"Ha!"
Cipher jabs a finger into Dalton's chest.
"You're getting better at the jokes, boy. They're even close to being funny. Also, you really gotta stop letting this girl of yours wander around the woods. If she's not tripping over dead bodies, she's rescuing wolf pups and throwing bear cubs, and now she's bringing home lost babies. Must be a talent."
"I don't find the dead bodies," I say. "I make them, to liven things up."
"Hey now, that's my line. You make any dead bodies lately, Ty?"
Dalton asks as we head for home.
"Just the kind I can throw into a stew. And before you ask, that doesn't include people. My hitman days are behind me. Unless you need someone put down, and then I'll make an exception."
"For a lifetime supply of coffee creamer?" I say.
"Hell no, kitten. I want the coffee, too. I'm a skilled tradesman. I don't come cheap."
He looks over at the baby.
"Mind if I hold the tyke when we get inside where it's warm?"
Dalton and I exchange a look. Cipher sees it and sputters.
"What? You think I'll drop her on her head? My own girl grew up just fine. Twice as smart as her old man."
"You have a daughter?" I say.
"I do indeed. She's a lawyer down in Hawaii. Not the profession I would have chosen, but she isn't fond of mine either. So we agree to disagree. She married a few years back, and she's got herself a pair of twin babies. Haven't broken them yet."
"You've seen them?" I say.
"Only once so far, but I plan to get down again this spring. Fly south with all the other snowbirds. Work on my tan on Waikiki."
I stare at him.
"What?"
he says.
"You've never heard of these big things called airplanes?" "Sure, first I gotta get to Dawson, and that's a good week's walk, which is why I don't do it in the middle of winter, even if I'd appreciate that sun and sand even more." "I never knew you had a kid,"
Dalton says.
"Because you never asked."
Cipher throws his hands in the air.
"No one asks. I'm just a crazy ex-sheriff who lives in the forest."
We're in Rockton now. People have heard us coming. More accurately, they heard Cipher. He tramps out of the forest like a Norse giant, clad in fur and snow. People clear a path all the way to the police station. The first time Cipher walked in, they'd scattered even faster. All Dalton's boogeymen of the forest stories bringing to life. They've seen him enough now that they don't flee. They just retreat. I'd lit the fire in the station before I left, and when we walk in, Dalton swings the kettle over the flames. Then he helps me out of the parka and takes the baby.
"She have a name?"
Cipher asks. I glance at Dalton.
"Abby,"
he says.
"Or that's what we're calling her for now."
Cipher takes Abby and dangles her in front of his face, his one hand supporting her neck.
"He didn't have your name stitched on your blanket? What kind of foundling are you?"
I settle in by the fire. "How much did Eric explain?"
"Just that we discovered a baby and a dead woman, who isn't the mother, and we need help finding the actual mother,"
Dalton says as he preps the French press.
"Tyrone wouldn't let me tell him more. His price for information is a one-night stay in Rockton with access to food and a shower. I agreed, but he refused to talk to anyone except you. I think he figured if I got his information, I'd renege on the bargain."
He shoots Cipher a look.
"I wasn't questioning your integrity, boy. Your voice just isn't nearly as sweet as Casey's. Now what's going on with this tyke?"
I explain. When I tell him who Edwin fingered as the family, he lets out a string of curses, and then stops short and puts his hands over the baby's ears before finishing. "You know them," I say.
"Fuck yeah."
"And they're not actually upstanding citizens."
"Fuck no."
I rise to take the whistling kettle, but Dalton beats me to it.
Edwin says they sell their girls, I say. Prostitute them.
Yeah. Sorry, kitten. I know you were hoping I'd say that's a load of hogwash, but it's not. I don't trade with that family unless I absolutely have to. They have some items I can't get elsewhere, and yeah, sex might be on that list of rare commodities, but I'm sure as hell not buying it like that.
Cipher settles in, grunting as he shifts his bulk.
I don't have an aversion to such trade in general. If a woman's willing and it's a clean transaction, well, I figure that's better than going into a bar and ending up with a woman who drank more than you realized. These particular traders offer me a girl every time, and they get the sharp side of my tongue instead. One of the girls even asked me to take her away and marry her.
He scratches his beard.
Shit. I didn't know what to do. Ended up saying no, and then spent a whole lot of time feeling bad about it. It's a complicated situation. I sure as hell don't want some little girl who stays with me because I rescued her. I could take her to Dawson, but what then? Give her a few grand and abandon her? She's never lived outside these woods. If that ever happens again, bring her here,
Dalton says.
It's not that simple,
Cipher says.
It isn't like those girls are tied to a wagon, beaten and bruised, and I'm trading with their daddy while pretending not to see them because I really need new underwear.
I snort and he arches his brows.
You think I'm kidding about the underwear, kitten? You try making them from deer hide. Going without ain't an option. I tried that one summer. It was warm enough. But then you got the chafing and the hanging and—
I hold up my hand. I get the pic— Nope, sorry. I don't get any picture at all. He chuckles.
Point is that those girls aren't being held against their will. There's three of them, sisters. And if I tried rescuing two of them, they'd scratch my damned eyes out. The third, the one who asked, wasn't looking for rescue. She just figured I'd be a good provider. If I did walk her to Dawson, she'd turn around and find her way back to her family.
He waves at Dalton.
Like you did, when the Daltons brought you to Rockton.
Dalton goes still. I stiffen, looking over. He says, very softly,
I tried to get back to my parents, to my family. Exactly,
Cipher says, blithely missing Dalton's body language.
You're better off here, but you still wanted to return to your folks out there.
Dalton's storm gray eyes fix on Cipher.
Better off?
Cipher waves away Dalton's words. He's ready to move on. I'm trying to decide what to do when I hear myself saying, why do you think that? Dalton's gone still again, his nostrils flaring as if he's struggling to breathe. I could withdraw the question. Maybe I should. I don't. Why do you think Eric was better off in Rockton? I press. Was something wrong with him? Was he sick? Malnourished?
Nothing like that. Now, I'm sure his folks were decent kids, but they were already leaving him to fend for himself. That ain't right.
What? Dalton says, his face screwing up.
Your daddy, Gene Dalton, saw you a few times out there all by yourself, hunting and fishing. You told him your parents gone off to trade and you were old enough to look after yourself. They must have taken Jakey with them. Gone for weeks they were, leaving you alone. That never,
Dalton struggles for words.
That did not happen. Yes, I was old enough to go hunting or fishing, but for a morning or an afternoon. If my parents went trading, we all went. I never spoke to anyone from Rockton before Gene Dalton captured me.
Cipher frowns.
And maybe you've forgotten. Anyway, I don't know the details, and I might not have had much use for Gene Dalton, but your mama was a good woman. She wouldn't have kept you if there wasn't a problem with your folks. I wouldn't have let them keep you either.
There's a set to Cipher's jaw, one that says he's not trying to convince Dalton. He's trying to convince himself. He believed whatever tale Gene Dalton spun, and he cannot afford to second guess now. Eric, I say. Maybe you want to take Abby home for a nap. You could check on Marianne, too. His lips tighten and my gut seizes. I shouldn't have asked about his parents. I should have respected Dalton's wishes and kept out of it until he was ready. When he sees my face,
He squeezes my hand and leans over to whisper,
"Nothing I didn't already suspect."
Before I can react, he says,
"Let me take Abby and Storm for a walk. I should check on Marianne. I'll be back in 20 minutes.
When Dalton's gone, I say to Cipher, "May I ask you a favor?"
"Sure, kitten. What is it?"
"Don't mention his family. Either one, really. He has good memories of his birth parents, and what the Daltons did is confusing. I know you didn't mean anything by it, but I'd be very happy if it didn't arise in conversation again." He looks toward the door Dalton exited.
"He's upset."
I could almost laugh at his genuine surprise. He really did miss the clues, even as they'd flashed neon bright. I remember who I'm talking to and limit my response to, "He's angry about what happened back then." Cipher looks at me.
"You can say he's upset, Casey. I'm not one of those assholes who'll give a guy flack for showing a bit of emotion. If it bothers him, I won't bring it up."
"Thank you. Now, about finding this baby's family."
"Yeah, that was a topic of conversation, wasn't it?"
He eyes me.
"As for giving the baby back, Edwin's right. Those traitors went on a long supply run."
He stretches his legs.
"Could be spring before they get back."
"Damn. So I guess we'll just need to adopt her."
"Seems like it. I know you and Eric are busy with your jobs, but you've got a town full of folks who'll help babysit, and you'd make good parents."
"People keep telling me that," I murmur. "So this family, they must have left in the last few days. You don't think we could catch up with them?"
"They move fast."
"Huh. Weird, though, don't you think, that they'd decide to do a supply run at this time of year? You said yourself that you wouldn't travel to Dawson in winter. Too hard going." He shrugs.
"As me."
"Yet they not only chose to leave as soon as the weather got bad, but they'll be away all winter when people would be most in need of trade goods, willing to pay dearly for food and ammo."
"I didn't say they were good traders."
"You and Edwin have decided the baby would be better off with us. I get that. Under the circumstances," I exhale. "Well, I don't know what's going to happen under the circumstances, but I'm not about to hand a baby girl back to a family who will prostitute her when she's old enough."
"They don't really wait until they're old enough."
"And you think I'd return a child to that?" "All I want is to assess the situation. Maybe they abandoned the baby. Edwin thinks so. Maybe the woman who died found her in the snow. Or maybe the mother is frantically searching for her child and can be convinced to leave her family and raise Abby in a safe place. I have no idea what our next move is, but I'd like you to trust us." He sighs.
"Don't get your back up, kitten. I know you and Eric gotta do the right thing, but sometimes doing the right thing isn't really doing the right thing, if you know what I mean. You tie yourselves into knots weighing the ethical and moral bullshit when common sense says fuck that. A kid has a choice between growing up with good parents who'll give her the best fucking life they can, and parents who'll whore her out before she's old enough for high school. Pretty sure no one sees much of a decision there. It just seems best to me if I say the family's long gone and any fault for a fib falls on me. I won't lose a moment's sleep over it."
"True. But now that I know you're fibbing, I will lose a ton of sleep over it, wondering if I should tell Eric my suspicions, wondering if I stole a baby from a young woman needing rescue herself, wondering if—
"Life would be a whole lot easier if you could just shut off that brain of yours. Same with Eric. Yeah, what happened to him was messy, but he's fine now. And the Daltons are down south, and his parents are dead, and he's still got Jacob. So what good does it do to dig up the past?"
I ignore that and say, "This family of traitors didn't go to Dawson. So the question is whether you're going to help us get to them or we're going to track them down on our own." He sighs and grumbles and says,
We can talk about that over dinner. I'm hungry, and I want a shower and a proper sit-down meal in your restaurant."
Chapter 21. Dalton returns with Abby and Storm just before we head out. We're putting Cipher up overnight in one of the empty apartments, and he wants to shower before dinner.
He also wants clean clothing and a full line of toiletries, including beard scissors.
You're going to dinner with us,
Dalton says.
It's not a date.
Cipher doesn't respond to that. I glance over and he's scratching his beard. When he catches my eye, he looks almost sheepish.
So,
he says, clearing his throat.
Earlier, I might have said I don't have any problem with the concept of purchasing the time of ladies.
He glances over, clearly hoping to be freed from this conversation with a nod of understanding. I frown, pretending I have no idea what he's talking about. He clears his throat again.
Last time I was here, I overheard a comment that led me to asking your deputy a question, which she confirmed.
Another look my way. Again, I offer Cipher no sign of rescue. Dalton's busy murmuring to Abby, who is awake and trying to look around. Cipher continues.
It seems you have legalized the sex trade in Rockton. So I thought maybe, if I clean myself up, one of your ladies might consider.
Dalton looks over, brows raised, as if he caught just the end of that conversation. He's getting himself dolled up because he is hoping for a date, I say. A paid one. Cipher glowers at me. What? I said. Did I misinterpret? He mutters under his breath. You can try, I say. But we need to front you credits. They don't take hides in trade. Probably best if I speak to Isabel and she can have a word with her girls and they can get a look at you over dinner and let her know what they think. It's entirely up to them.
As it should be,
he says.
But, well, while I'm open to possibilities, there was one lady in particular who caught my eye. That's what led to the conversation with Deputy Will. She came by to give him shit about something, and he made a comment, and after she left, I confirmed the sex trade thing. I'm presuming from his comment that she's one of the ladies for hire.
Ah, you already have your date picked out. I'll ask Will who. Before I can finish, Jen marches over. You steal my baby and you don't bring her back? I said her feeding time was 6 and it's already 10 after, and I see you just waltzing around with her while she freezes her tiny ass off. As she talks, Cipher steps away, quickly. I don't blame him. I'd like to escape too. But something in the way he quickly sidesteps catches my attention. Jen sees him. Oh, it's Grizzly Adams. Come down from the mountain, did you? You don't need to jump. I don't bite.
I wasn't jumping, miss. I was moving downwind so you don't smell me before I get a shower, which I was just about to do.
I've spent the last 2 days changing shitty diapers. You can't smell any worse than that. Jen reaches for Abby. Gimme. I catch the look Cipher is giving her, and I accidentally say, Jen? Aloud. And she turns on me with a snapped, what? I motion to Dalton, whose eyebrows disappear under his hat. He looks from Cipher to Jen. What? Jen repeats. I think we'll keep the baby for now, I say. We'll feed her, and then Petra wanted a visit. We'll leave her and Storm there over dinner. Would you mind doing us a favor, though? Tyrone's going to get cleaned up and grab dinner at the Lion, and I'm not sure we'll be done with the baby in time. It's probably best if he doesn't walk into the Lion unescorted. You want me to eat dinner with Grizzly Adams? She looks over at him and shrugs. Fine with me, but you better make sure he wants to have dinner with me. He looks ready to bolt back into the forest.
Like I said, miss, I just don't smell too good.
It's Jen. I haven't been a miss for a long time. If you're okay eating with me, then sure, go get your shower. I'll come by in 30 minutes. Just don't make me wait. I'm hungry. She leaves before he can answer. I call after her. Thanks, and dinner's on us. It better be, she calls back. When she's out of earshot, I say, that's all we're paying for, too. Dalton watches Jen.
She's the...
Can't even get the rest out, can you? I murmur.
She's a little rough around the edges,
Cipher says.
I'm not exactly smooth myself.
He eyes her retreating form.
You think I have a shot? I mean, if I pay, obviously.
Here's the thing,
I say. When Will said we have sex workers, he didn't mean Jen. Yes, he may have made a smart-ass comment to her. That's because she's been known to moonlight, which is strictly prohibited. As far as I know, she hasn't done that in a while. So my advice is to have a nice dinner, see how it goes, and if she makes you an offer, I'll tell Isabel it's a special case.
A charity case,
Dalton says. Cipher pokes him in the chest.
How about you just go back to not trying to be funny, boy? I don't need charity. I just need a long shower, some good soap, and clean clothing. And beard trimmers.
Or hedge clippers, I say.
Oh, you do, huh? I clean up just fine, as you will see.
Actually, we won't. You get Jen all to yourself. Tell her we decided to eat in with the baby tonight. Go have your date and try not to spend too much of our money. We're at home with Abby and Storm. Dalton checked on Marianne earlier and she's fine. He sensed she'd had enough company for the day, so he had Anders take her dinner and a few supplies and she's in for the night. Anders will keep an eye on the place and make sure no one goes nosing around. He'll also let us know if Marianne gets skittish and bolts. I feed Storm and then Abby, while Dalton makes dinner. He's better at that. It wasn't a skill I developed at home. We had a housekeeper who cooked. That's no excuse, I know. It just always seemed like there were other things to do, and it was easier to buy takeout or cook a pot of pasta or slap together a sandwich. I can cook, I'm just not very good at it. And the limited ingredients here frustrate me. Dalton's never known anything else. Tonight, he's making venison cutlets with a mushroom ragu on a bed of egg noodles. Everything is fresh. The meat hunted, the mushrooms picked and dried, the egg noodles handmade. We may not have a supermarket's worth of variety here, but the food is worthy of a posh Toronto eatery. I'm putting Abby to bed when Dalton declares dinner ready. We eat in front of the fireplace, Storm at our feet, Dalton stretched out on the sofa, me curled up at the other end, plates on our laps, wine glasses on the side tables. I plan to find other conversation for the meal, but as soon as we settle and I open my mouth, I hear myself saying, I'm sorry. He glances over, brows rising. Earlier, with Tyrone, when he mentioned your parents, I should have dropped it, and I didn't. He turns to me, and his head tilts just a little, eyes piercing with a look I know well from our earliest days. That keen scrutiny, as if he's trying to peer right into my brain and figure out what I'm thinking.
Is that what was bothering you?
He says. I glance over. He sets his plate down, one knee coming up onto the sofa.
You looked freaked out when Tyrone was talking, and I thought you were just shocked by what he said. Were you honestly worried I'd be mad at you for asking?
It's your business, and if you wanted details, you'd ask. I shouldn't do it for you. I put my fork down. It's not just for you either. I want to know. I want to understand. That isn't right. His head tilts again.
Being concerned for me isn't right.
I flail my hands. Complicated.
Yeah, it is. Those relationships are complicated. Ours isn't. And if I'm making it complicated, you gotta tell me so I can stop. I sure as hell don't want you thinking you need to tread lightly or you'll piss me off. You ask the obvious question, one I should have asked myself, but
he shrugs.
It feels like picking at a scab. That scab's not healing, though.
He exhales, a long hiss of breath between his teeth.
I just don't want to get into it.
He stops, lips parting.
Fuck, that sounds bad. It's not that I don't want to get into it with you. I don't want to get into it with myself. Best to stuff it under the bed and tell myself it doesn't matter. Except it does matter. I haven't gone to see the Daltons since you arrived, and part of that's because when we have time off, I want to be with you. But part of it is that you give me an excuse. They're my parents, and I should want to see them. Only they're not my parents, and unless they have a damned good excuse for what they did, I'm not eager to spend my free time with them.
He looks over at me.
They don't have a good excuse, do they?
I have no way of knowing that, Eric.
But you think the same thing I do. They lied about my situation. They made shit up to justify bringing me into Rockton.
Jean did. He rubs his mouth.
Yeah, and I don't know how to deal with that because my gut says he lied to my mother, too. He presented her with a situation she wouldn't argue with. Like Edwin trying to tell us the baby had been abandoned. If that's the case, then I'm doing a shitty thing shutting Catherine Dalton out of my life. But if it's not, if she knew too?
He looks at me.
If she knew too, that's gonna hurt. I need those answers. I'm not ready to march down south and get them. But you don't ever need to worry that you're going to upset me by prodding. Fuck knows I'm the king of pushing people to face shit they don't want to face.
He lifts my plate and holds it out.
Eat.
When I hesitate, he leans in, his forehead touching mine.
I love you. You know that. Sometimes I wish there was something more to say. A higher escalation. I can't find the words to go beyond it, you know?
I nod, still not speaking. I feel his breath on my lips, close enough to kiss, but he stays there, just breathing.
I'm still afraid,
he says,
of doing something to scare you off. I'm mostly past it, but I worry that if I dive into this and I can't deal with it, you'll decide I'm just too fucked up to be with.
Pretty sure my baggage is as heavy as yours.
Yeah, but what's in your baggage has been sorted and arranged, and you open it up for a look now and then. Mine's stuffed in a suitcase full of bursting, held by triple locks, and I don't even peek inside. You shouldn't feel like I'd go ballistic if you even jangle the lock, especially when I'm throwing yours open, rifling through it, tossing shit everywhere so I can see what you've got in there.
I laugh softly. That is an awesome analogy.
Thank you. Totally true, too. I love you. I don't want to lose you. You're going to need to be patient with me. Right now, my life is fucking awesome. And if there's this one suitcase under the bed that I don't want to touch, I know that isn't healthy, but I'm not ready to rip it open. You may, however, jangle the locks now and then to remind me it's there, and that I need to deal with it eventually.
I press my lips to his. It's meant to be quick, but he bears into it, pulling me against him, the kiss hungry, edged with desperation. I slide my plate onto the table and pull him to me as I fall back onto the couch. Chapter 22. I'm on the floor, resting on my stomach, eyeing my plate of half-eaten food. You know what we need? I say. A microwave. Dalton snorts and pushes up.
You Southerners make everything complicated.
He pulls out a tray that hangs over the fire, sets our plates on it, and adjusts it over the flames. Storm lumbers over to lie closer to the fire. She doesn't even eye the plates. She knows better. A microwave would be faster, I say.
But it wouldn't give the meat that nice smoky taste. And if you were so hungry, maybe you shouldn't have insisted on sex halfway through dinner.
Insisted? I sputter. I don't even remember asking.
Exactly. That only makes it worse.
I pitch a pillow at him. He catches it, scoops me up, and deposits me on the sofa, then drops the pillow on my head. When I go to throw it back at him, he lifts my wine glass, and I stop.
Thought that'd work.
He says, handing me the glass as he takes away the pillow.
Don't want to spill the wine.
He's about to settle in beside me when the baby wails. He levers up, but I put a hand on his knee. I've got this, I say. I root my panties and bra out of the pile of clothing. Somehow, this seems the proper line between acceptable and unacceptable attire in front of an infant who can't see more than blobs. I pull them on as I head upstairs. By the time Abby is changed, our meal is warmed. You eat first, I say. I'll handle cuddling duty. I sit on the sofa with Abby, and she snuggles against my bare skin. Storm lies on my feet. I have Abby cradled in my arms, which apparently is the proper position for breastfeeding, because her head turns and her tiny mouth clamps down on my bra. I laughed and shift her away, murmuring, sorry,
as I sweep my hair back over my shoulder. I look over at Dalton, and I'm about to make a comment when I see he's staring, and the look on his face. It's the same look I'm sure I had, watching him cradle the baby that first time. An expression of revelation and a pang of unexpected longing from some instinctive place. He looks away quickly and says something, too gruff to make out. I slide over and kiss his beard-rough cheek. He turns to meet the kiss, hands slipping into my hair. It's a quick one, and then I'm back in my corner, watching him eat as he sneaks almost guilty glances my way. We'll have to deal with this, with the questions Abby raises for us. But I'm no longer freaking out at the thought. For now, we have other concerns. I start by telling him Marianne's story. He stops eating several times as I talk, chewing over my words with his dinner, but he says nothing until I'm done. Then he's done too, and he wordlessly switches his plate for the baby so I can eat. "Huh," he says as he bounces Abby, hand behind her head, as if this has become second nature. "Yep," I say. "Huh, indeed." Thank God I didn't tell anyone else about my council is responsible for the hostiles theory. You should have seen the look I got when I asked Marianne whether anyone else could be involved. I felt like Brent with his crazy conspiracy theories. I pull my legs up, sitting sideways and cross-legged as I dangle one hand to pet Storm. For the record, I knew I was being paranoid suspecting the council.
"Yeah," Dalton says. "Because they are never behind the weird shit that happens here. It's not like they're bringing in killers without warning us, or setting spies among us, or planting a goddamn secret agent to assassinate liabilities."
Petra will love secret agent. She might want a badge. He snorts.
"Nice job of ignoring my point, detective. You never blame the council. You only floated the possibility. Your primary suspicion was simply that the hostiles didn't just devolve into fucking savages after a year or two in the wild. Now we know your main hypothesis is correct. The hostiles aren't residents gone wild. They're a cult."
My brows shoot up. Shades fall over his eyes. The pride of a brilliant man who realizes he can misunderstand concepts those from down south take for granted. It only lasts a second, though, before he relaxes as he remembers who he's with.
"Yeah,"
he says.
"That might not be the right word. We had someone up here a few years back escaping a cult, so I did some reading. Maybe not as much as I should have."
The fact that you did any research to help understand a resident situation puts you head and shoulders above most of us, Eric. And my look didn't mean you had the wrong idea. It was surprise that you had the right one. When he chuckles, I say, "Sorry, that came out wrong. I'm not surprised that you had a good idea. I'm surprised because I hadn't thought of it that way. While I never dealt with cults down south, I did attend a seminar on them. Most times you have a charismatic person recruiting easy targets, people who want to get rich or feel loved and accepted, depending on what your cult is selling. They're always selling something. The hostiles don't fit that."
"Yeah, crappy analogy."
No, it's not, because the basic idea still works. People who leave Rockton are seeking something. A more natural way of life and a stronger community. Most of all, though, they're looking for a new experience. That's what Marianne wanted. The hostiles aren't willing recruits, though. Sure, I suppose it's possible someone could be attracted to that lifestyle, but mostly they're being brainwashed. That's where the cult analogy works best.
"It starts with the T," Dalton says. "A group of settlers, maybe with some experience in drugs, looking for that kind of back-to-nature experience. Rockton got a lot of that in the early years. People grew their own marijuana, their own mushrooms. Neither was particularly conducive to productivity, though."
I smile. "No, I suppose not. But yes, back to nature can mean plant-based methods of communing with the forest. Early settlers probably did experiment with what they found out there." I turn to him. "What is out there, anyway?"
"Fuck if I know. We still get residents poking around. They end up in the clinic for smoking all kinds of shit."
I laugh. He shifts Abby to his other arm.
"No one's ever found anything that'll send them on a drug trip. My guess is that whoever concocted this tea knew exactly what they were doing. They didn't just randomly throw plants into a pot."
The inventor and their fellow settlers get into it, and everyone likes how it makes them feel. It makes them more comfortable with violence, more fixated on daily survival, and less concerned with everything that gets in the way of it.
The tea hones their survival instincts and dulls their self-awareness, so they don't sit around moaning about wanting a shower.
I remember what Marianne said about how that was the big concern with her parents' hippie friends. Scarcity of creature comforts is the thing people complain about most in Rockton. I've learned to live without a microwave and internet access, but that doesn't mean I don't feel the lack of them. That's where Dalton has the advantage.